So. And welcome to Eye to the Sky, the UFO synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network, being broadcast live on 105.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, DeAndrew, and tonight my guest is James E. Clarkson. We also have another way that you can listen to this program, simply by calling area code 704-631-4060. And entering our four-digit station ID code, which is 2899. The phone number again, 704-631-4063, and ID code 2899. Tonight, my guest, James Clarkson, is the chief investigator for MUFON in Washington State. He received an Army Commendation Medal for investigative work in 1977, prior to his honorable discharge. He served for 20 years in the Aberdeen, Washington Police, retiring as a sergeant with assignments as detective sergeant, patrol sergeant, fatal accident team supervisor, and he later worked as a child abuse detective until he was hired as a fraud investigator for the state of Washington. In 93, James met June Crane and became both her friend and the primary researcher into her past, when she worked in classified laboratories at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base from 1943 to 1953. June Crane described from experience what the scientists and engineers of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base knew about UFOs. Her revelations became an important testimony in support of the Majestic Documents Research Project. James Clarkson is also the primary researcher in the Westport, Washington UFO crash of 1979, involving members of the community, local law enforcement, and the military. James Clarkson is also scheduled to present his findings at the 6th Annual UFO Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada, November 7th through the 9th. He has been presenting UFO information to the public in Washington for the past 15 years, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to the show. Not back to the show, but to the show for the first time, because we originally had him scheduled for a couple of weeks ago, but unfortunately a little hurricane, well, it made its appearance in New Orleans, and we had to cancel that evening. And James, I thank you very much for rescheduling with us and taking some time out from your busy schedule to join us tonight.
Well, thank you, Dee. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I've really been looking forward to this.
Oh, so have I. As you know, Roswell is one of my favorite topics, and a lot of what she covers, well, not a lot, but a part of what she covered in or June Crane covered in her interview, dealt with the Roswell incident and many other incidents as well.
Well, one of the best ways, I guess, to explain the June story is to tell the story of how I met her. And so I guess I have to thank the more traditional media and their coverage of the Roswell event in 1997 for ever getting to talk to June, because I first met her in 1993. I started giving library programs. The area where I live in, there's an organization called the Timberland Regional Library System. There's about two dozen libraries spread over five counties, and I decided as part of my work with the Mutual UFO Network that I would start giving public presentations with the hope of just getting people interested, trying to get them to ask questions, and basically opening up the minds of anybody I could to the possibility and what I think is the almost certainty that we've been contacted repeatedly throughout our history. Well, in 1993, I gave one of my presentations in Ocean Shores, Washington, And after I was all done, this very determined elderly woman came up to me when I was done, and she said, "You're right. The government knows all about UFOs, and they're not telling us." And so I said to her, I said, "Well, June," after we were introduced, I said, "Will you tell me more?" And she said, "I can't. They'll come and arrest me." And I think that part of why she didn't want to talk to me was at that time I was still in the police department. And the other part, of course, was I learned later she had signed a non-disclosure agreement when she left the employment of the Air Force in 1953, stating that if she ever told what she had seen or heard while she worked at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, that she would be subject to a $20,000 fine and possibly be sent to prison. So
that would be enough to keep anybody quiet.
I think so. And it wasn't until 1997 when we came up to the 50th anniversary of the Roswell event, and I think you probably remember, as do I, that right before the July 4th anniversary, all at once we had all these news stories on CNN, and I think the Air Force released this statement and said this was like their fourth or fifth final explanation for Roswell, and they said they were going to really tell us the truth. And actually, it was a top-secret balloon project called Project Mogul. And, oh, by the way, we had dummies attached to the balloons, and that must be why everybody talks about little green men. And so you can all go home, and nobody needs to go to Roswell to celebrate the event. Of course, as I recall, nobody listened, and I think that was the most crowded that the city of Roswell, New Mexico, ever was on the 50th anniversary. Well, my part of that was that one day I got a telephone call out of the blue, no warning, and it was June, and she started saying, "It's a damn lie." And I said, "Well, June, good to hear from you again." And I asked her why she was calling me, and she says, "Well, have you seen the news coverage on CNN? She was very excited. And I said, "Well, yes, I've been watching it." And she said, "It's the old balloon story. They've used that several times. It was a lie then, and it's a lie now." And so I said, "Well, why are you talking to me now?" And that was, she said something I'll never forget. She said, "I'm 72 years old. I've outlived two husbands. My cancer's in remission. What are they going to do, shoot me or put me in prison? I can do either one." Well, I knew that was an opportunity, and I said, "Well, how soon can I be at your house?" And that's how we became friends. I started going to visit her and having coffee with her. I was working swing shift then, so I got off duty at the police department, and then I drove about 20 miles out to the coast to her home, and we stayed up late talking about her life and her experiences. And I was absolutely amazed at where she had been and what she had done, because it was like getting a chance to look at a really key period of time, not only in the UFO field, but a big transition for the defense establishment of our country. Because when she started in 1943, she told me that there wasn't even a fence around the base. And in fact, she recalled as a young girl growing up in Dayton, Ohio, when Pearl Harbor happened, on December 7th of 1941, they immediately rushed soldiers out to this little airfield and had soldiers stand shoulder to shoulder because there were no fences, there were no guard posts, and they were afraid of sabotage. She was able to describe all of this history to me. She gave me her documents. She showed me her promotional history, times where she had been given commendations for suggestions she made on better security. And so I mean, you look at those documents plus her testimony, she's an extremely credible woman. And she obviously lived through this time period, to include the time when the Air Force was actually born in 1947, which some of us, of course, think may be no small coincidence. Prior to that, it was the Army Air Corps. And, of course, that's the same year that the CIA was created, the same year that several of the top secret alphabet soup agencies were born is late in 1947 when the National Security Act was enacted. Well, June lived through this history while she was working there. In fact, some of her documents, they didn't even have the new paperwork yet, and they actually used a typewriter, and I hope, I certainly remember using a typewriter. There are probably people out there who don't quite know what one was, but they actually struck out with big X's Army Air Corps and typed in the United States Department of the Air Force because they didn't even have the new paperwork yet.
And if I remember right, too, when you were saying about the soldiers shoulder to shoulder, didn't she say that the house she lived in at the time was just a stone's throw away from the border of the base?
Exactly. And she told me, she said, if you were a young woman and you wanted to get a good job in Dayton, Ohio, you went to work for the government, which seemed perfectly logical to me. And she was able to relate a history of, you know, the efforts that were made, espionage and counter-espionage. She worked in an office where they had to take the typewriter ribbons out at night and lock them up in a safe, because the idea being that if an enemy agent got a hold of your typewriter ribbon, they could figure out what you had been working on. And everything where she worked was highly classified, and at one point, part of her job was to be in charge of multiple safes. In other words, this is before computers, so they had to have a method of checking highly classified information in and out every day so that these scientists and engineers could work on the various projects that they were involved in. And of course, many of these things are things that we take for granted now, but at the time, they were cutting-edge technology, such as the ejection seat for a jet fighter aircraft, gun sight aperture cameras, how to drop a heavy payload onto a battlefield with a parachute. This was the typical work that she was involved in. But there was another side, and it's this other side that was really interesting to me, because she overheard the scientists and engineers talking about UFOs. And at this point in time, you have to kind of take yourself back mentally and think about where we were before NASA, where we were before there was a man on the moon program, any of those things like that. This is back, you think about after World War II, we and the Russians were trying to get all of the German rocket technology that we could that had been used in the V-2 rockets, and they were going down to New Mexico and trying to fly rockets like the Aerobee and some of the other early rockets that we had to see how big of a payload they could fire into the stratosphere, or eventually how big of a payload they could put into orbit. This is before anybody was talking about manned space flight or space shuttles or anything like that. And she was in on knowing all the scientists and engineers who were involved in that early history. They would come back from New Mexico, where they would go to launch these rockets, and they would come back to their regular assignments at Wright-Patterson, and they would talk about all of the UFOs that they had seen. The inference that I got from June was that they saw UFOs so commonly that they felt like they were under surveillance while they were doing these rocketry experiments. And in the other side of that was, they quit bothering to report them officially because they were discouraged. And by discouraged, she explained that to me. They would take you if you reported a UFO, no matter who you were, and they would basically isolate you and debrief you, which would be a long, arduous procedure that nobody really wanted to go through. So after a certain time, if you know that you're going to be put through this, they just quit reporting them. But that didn't mean that they weren't seeing them, and it didn't mean that they weren't talking about them with each other. It just meant that they weren't reporting them officially. And that's kind of an interesting insight, because it always makes me wonder how many good UFO sightings don't get reported.
This is true, and it makes you wonder. And then, like you were saying, they would isolate these people that did report anything for a minimum of 24 hours.
Exactly. And bear in mind that these witnesses are scientists and engineers that already have a security clearance. June worked in an environment where everybody had to have a security clearance. In other words, the place where she worked, the laboratories, this is a secured area inside of a secured base. So in other words, you'd have to go through several checkpoints to get to where she worked. And this was her normal work environment. So in other words, they would have a break room like everywhere else. If there had been such a thing for a woman in that day and time, June would have been an office manager, clearly. But women were not allowed to have roles or titles like that. So what it happened was she was the only office, the only woman in an office that was filled with military men, scientists, and engineers. So she's in an all-male environment. And I think this has something to do with some of the things that she overheard and some of the conversations that she had. I think some of these men were flirting with her, and that they were probably saying things that if they had thought about it a little more carefully, they probably wouldn't have said.
This is true. I know that she was quite taken with Hap Arnold.
Yes, I remember that. She talked about how he was such a handsome man and all of that. Well, of course, he's a famous aviator, and there were a couple of incidents that she was involved in that are truly remarkable. One of them in particular, she showed me this. I have a wedding photo that she gave me where the wedding took place on Wright-Patterson at a chapel, and you can see that it's that kind of building. And there are all these people there, and she could not, you got to bear in mind that she's trying to reconstruct all of this and telling me things. This is somewhat, you know, some of it is 50 years later in her life, and I can only imagine. I'm not quite that old. I guess it would be like me trying to remember what I knew when I was 6 years old exactly. Now, of course, she was an adult, and she had many details, and she still had all of her personal papers, so it was a lot easier for her to reconstruct some of this. But my point being, there's a gentleman named Master Sergeant Clarence. She wasn't able to give me a last name. And that's one of the big frustrations in researching the June story, because according to her, this is the Master Sergeant who one morning, right about the time of the Roswell crash, was at Wright-Patterson, and while they were talking about, as she called it, his news for the day, he said that he had flown in from New Mexico with bodies and pieces of a saucer. And supposedly, of course, this is her description, that they were the classic bluish green, about 4 feet tall, and that they were non-human. Now, later on that same day, after they're all at work, here comes a courier from the commander of the base who was delivering what he called a too-hot memo, or what she called it. The too-hot memo is a procedure whereby you take this one individual, goes from person to person, they have to stop what they're doing and read the memo and sign off. Now, this memo said that some irresponsible person had been spreading rumors around the base that bodies and pieces of a saucer had been flown in from New Mexico, and that if anybody talked about this anymore and it became known to the commander, they could be fined or imprisoned. So, of course, the question being, why would the commander even care if there's no truth to any of this? This is another one of those classic situations that we find in this field of study over and over again. I guess the Shakespeare line covers it the best. The lady doth protest too much. And in this case, the lady happens to be the Air Force, or it can be the establishment in general, or whatever agency you're dealing with when you're trying to get UFO information. You can almost make out the shape of what we're really dealing with by putting together all of the lies and cover-up that are associated with this subject. They go to such great lengths to dismiss it and downplay it that it almost has to be real, even aside from the evidence. That's what fascinates me and one of the things that keeps me going in this field.
Well, and then, you know, the Hawking, she was talking about the think tank, and where she was saying that these scientists were saying that, well, you know, they're here, they're among us, and they have our shape, our form, and look like ordinary people. Okay, that was what, back in the late 40s, early 50s?
Exactly. And that's kind of, that's one of those theories, of course, that sort of raises the hair on the back of your neck, and it's been echoed by other researchers since then. And of course, that sort of fits in with the whole abductee experience, which is another whole chapter in the development of study of UFOs.
Well, and then I also thought it was rather, I hesitate to use the term coincidence, but that the same think tank said collectively, I'm assuming, that if they did make themselves known, it would wipe out all religious belief. And doesn't that kind of go along with the Robertson panel?
Yes, and it also goes along with the Brookings Institute study of what I believe was 1968, where they arrived at several conclusions about what the impact would be of a revelation that we had been contacted by a technologically superior species, that we would be in much the same situation as the Native Americans were when the Europeans invaded North America and brought their technology and, you know, a lot of deceitful behavior. The Native American cultures were overwhelmed, and many of them didn't survive. And, of course, this is their justification for not telling us what I believe some people know as a certainty.
Oh, and then a lot of what Ms. Crane was talking about supports a lot of the Majestic 12 documents that are out there.
Exactly. There's another level where she had an experience. She said that she knew that there was a place on the base where these bodies were kept. But, of course, the two aspects of security are that you have to have the right security clearance and you have to have a need to know. Well, she knew that there was a place on Wright-Patterson called the Aero Med Lab. And she believed, based upon talking to other people, that this is where the bodies were kept and where they may be kept to this day, for all we know. But she was not allowed to go there. This was beyond her, you know, beyond her level. She did, however, have an incident where she may have touched an alien artifact. Specifically, she may have had an opportunity to handle what everyone has called the memory metal. And this, of course, there's two kinds of metal that are around, one of which, by the way, I think I got to hold a piece of it once, and that also is connected to what I learned from June indirectly. But the other metal is the memory metal, that being the ultralight, extremely strong, extremely durable metal that when you wrinkle it up, or you can't wrinkle it up, you try to fold it up, you can crush it, and it springs back to its original shape, and it looks like no one's even touched it. Well, one day an officer came in, I believe she called him Lieutenant Rose, and he was obviously kind of talking out of turn and trying to make conversation with June, and you have that picture of her. That's the picture I think she would like to be remembered by, that's on the Majestic Documents website. You have to picture her as a tall young woman in this all-male environment, and in comes this lieutenant who wants to impress her. So he reaches into his pocket and he pulls out this piece of metal and shows it to June, and he says, "Here, June, go ahead, take a look at this. You try and tear it up." So he gets her to go after it with a pair of scissors. And she can't dent it, she can't cut it, she can't scratch it, she can't do anything with it. Except she can wad it up, and when she lets it go, it looks like It's never been damaged and never been touched. And this, of course, is the memory metal that remembers its correct shape. And supposedly, if the theory all hangs together right, this may have been part of the Roswell spacecraft. And so
she also seemed to be fascinated with the texture of it.
Exactly. Light as a feather and very smooth.
Almost and, slick.
Pardon?
From what I was reading of the interview, almost slick.
Yes. And so she said, where did this come from? And this lieutenant says, it's a piece of a spaceship. And she says, where did it really come from? And he repeated himself and said, it's a piece of a spaceship. And about that time is when someone walked by, there was some kind of commotion, and he immediately grabbed the medal and stuck it into his pocket and pretended like he had never talked to her. This is just one little incident, but if you take who June was and where she worked, and you back it up with her documentation, you back it up with her Q-level security clearance, and the whole nature of what she relates in context, I don't think it's a big leap to say that this happened to her. Now, can we absolutely prove it? No, we can't. But we can prove that June was the person she said she was, and that she really did work there, and she really, you know, had that kind of a work history. So I guess what I'm driving at is, based upon my experience, if she was a sworn witness in a court of law, she would be a credible witness that would probably convince a jury.
She also trusted you very well. She, from what I understand, she, without you knowing, made you the sole owner to the rights to her story.
Yes, and that was a great honor. And I got this envelope one day from an attorney. I wondered what it was at my home address, and I opened it, and it was a signed statement, notarized statement from her, giving me the rights to her life story. And I guess that's probably, to put that into context, was that she passed away in August of 1998. And I think that she didn't, I mean, nobody knows exactly when they're going to pass on. She had had several bouts with cancer. Her health was not the greatest. I think that she knew that this was part of her telling her story. And so, in fact, my last conversation with her when she was in a nursing home, and I said, what do you want me to do? And she said, I want you to tell my story. And so that's what I have done by, you know, every place that I could think of. And in fact, it was one night I was listening. We had regular AM, FM radios in the police cars, and there are times when it's not terribly busy, and they let you listen to the radio as long as it doesn't interfere with your duties. And I listened to the Art Bell Show, and I heard Ryan Wood talking about the Majestic Documents. And I was spellbound. I mean, I'd read books over the years about UFOs, of course, and, you know, kept up to date as much as possible, but the Majestic Documents, in my opinion, took everything to a whole other level. So I called up the next day and I said, I'd really like to get copies of these documents. And by the way, I'm a police sergeant in Aberdeen, Washington, and I have this story. And I started telling them about June Crane and who she was and where she worked. And they said, we're really interested. In fact, they were so interested that I got a call not too long thereafter, and I was asked to fly to Southern California, and they actually paid for my wife and I both to attend this conference that was funded by a man named Joe Firmage. And I went into this room, and suddenly I had all these people around me. In fact, some of them, I think, have been your guests, and I know that a lot of them are people that I highly respect in this field, and their books are on my bookshelf, and I was truly honored to be amongst these people, like Linda Moulton Howe and people like that. and we all presented what we had to each other. And I was really honored and flattered at how well received the June story was. And as time went on, I realized that it really serves as a, I guess, as an underpinning, as a foundation to some of these other revelations that people have made about crashed UFOs, the recovery of bodies, the whole extent to which there is a, shall we say, a deeper knowledge and reality of contact with extraterrestrials than what is normally given to the public. And so I felt when I was amongst these people that I had, you know, sort of graduated. And this, of course, is something that I've been interested in and that I've always had this great love for. So once again, June had given me something really valuable, and I was able to take what she had given me and pass it on, thereby keeping my promise to her to tell her story.
I remember hearing, oh, geez, I forget how long ago. I don't remember whether it was UFO Files or some other UFO documentary, audio clip of her telling different aspects of her story. And I was glued to it. I just thought, man, I wish this woman was still alive. I'd love to meet her.
Yes, I do too, because I think if I had had more time, had more time, I think I could have gotten, you know, we could have uncovered more information by, you know, going over her past. One of the things that you learn as an investigator, and I find that this is illustrated over and over again, is that it takes more than one interview to get the whole story. You know, anybody who thinks that you're going to just walk up to a witness and say, just the facts, ma'am, you know, that's not going to happen. Nobody will tell you anything until they trust you and they believe that you believe in them. And that's, you know, that's how you really interview people if you want to get information, is you have to create some kind of a trust between you. And in June's case, it was pretty easy because she was a what-you-see-is-what-you-get person. In fact, she had told off a number of local politicians out in Ocean Shores, and she had some credibility because she'd led several highly successful charity drives. In fact, if you go to Ocean Shores right now, they have a pretty new library building. It's been around for a few years now, and out front, there's a plaque dedicating the building to her because she led the charity drive that helped this community build a new library. So that's the kind of person she was. She lived in this home by a canal. That's Ocean Shores is kind of a spit of land out with the ocean on one side and the canal on the other. And it's a very funny town. It's beautiful, but it has hundreds of miles of roads that they struggle to maintain because they have way more roads than they have a tax base. Well, her home was on one of these back roads, and she was a fantastic gardener, even at her age, and with her health, she still managed to get out there, and she had a green thumb. Everything grew for her. She had all these animals. She had named all the squirrels and raccoons and everything else. She was just a real character. I mean, she was an interesting, fun person to know anyway, aside from her UFO knowledge.
Reading her in the interview, which, by the way, if you'd like to read this interview, if you go to my website at eye2thesky.net, and on the recommended online reading link, the very top link on that page is to a PDF file of this interview with June. You'll find it fascinating reading. But one aspect in that I thought was really neat was how she was talking about a flying saucer flying right over her and about 40 other people, and her descriptions of it was beautiful. It was just beautiful. And the reaction of another woman there holding on to her going, I didn't see this. It was just an amazing account from this woman.
that was a sighting down in, I believe, Portland, Oregon area. And my reaction to that story is that I thought that was kind of fascinating because it's so much like, in microcosm, what we get from sightings in general. Some people accept the experience. Some people fight it. Some people don't get it at all. You know, I mean, that's almost like her and that other woman is almost like Betty and Barney Hill. I mean, they both underwent this fantastic encounter, and Betty Hill, of course, was a woman who was filled with curiosity, and even though she was in an extraordinarily strange situation, she was trying to learn more and get insight into it. Her husband was completely terrified and traumatized and fought the whole thing. And so, yes, I remember the story with June and that other woman, and I remember how excited, you know, I could see it in her eyes when she was telling me. And that's something I've seen before in interviewing other UFO witnesses, is that when they get to the point where they're describing the experience, you can tell from their voices, you pick up on the emotional intensity that's surrounding the actual event when they're describing it to you. And to me, I always think that that's a sign of credibility. Unless the person is a really fantastic actor, I don't think that can be faked.
Well, and then she was very good at describing this object as well and how the two halves rotated.
Exactly. And that, of course, is classic.
Yeah, a lot of people who have investigated this for, oh gosh, good portions of their lives have never even had a sighting. And then there's those of us who have had multiple sightings. It makes you wonder. But getting deeper into June's story, what, in your opinion, is the most amazing thing she's told you?
I guess if I had to pick one thing out, it would be that by the time she left, that the government was aware of and had knowledge of, and in fact probably had physical evidence from, not one, but at least three crashes by 1953. And that they had used the balloon story repeatedly to cover up what people were, you know, excited about, what people had reported. And I guess for me, that's the most important part. And evidently, that struck a real deep chord with the Majestic Documents researchers. There was that and the Too Hot Memo story, because they had had other people talk to them about the use of a Too Hot Memo to get people to be quiet. So it's just, to me, the whole thing was exciting. It's hard to pick out one particular event. It's because of the documentation. In other words, I've been a professional investigator all of my life. I'm looking for something, in which I've met people who told me extraordinary stories about UFOs. Some of them I found highly credible. Some of them I'm not so sure of. June would only go so far in the telling. Whereas I talked to her repeatedly. She didn't change her story. She didn't deviate. Her testimony was consistent, and she only knew, if she didn't know, she didn't know. And so I guess what really got me excited was that she was so credible. She had integrity. She was an honest person. She was somebody I knew. And I actually got to meet somebody who had been there, who had some kind of direct experience. I, for all of my dedication to this field of study, I have not had a direct experience myself. I would love to. I mean, if it was to happen 5 minutes from now, nobody would be more excited than me. But I've yet to have it happen. But I've also been an investigator long enough to know that, you know, we routinely convict people of crimes when there are no eyewitnesses to the crime. Things are investigated. We look for evidence. We use witness testimony. We try to get physical evidence. We try to prove that something actually happened a certain way. And the evidence is overwhelming that there's something going on, and the greatest part about meeting June was that she, for me, she made this all real and immediate. It wasn't, you know, just an intellectual exercise anymore.
Well, on a bit of a lighter side of her experience at Wright-Patterson, you want to tell the silly putty story?
The silly putty story? I'm not sure. I'm sure what you're referring to.
Where she was telling about how I believe it was a lieutenant came up to her and says, "Hold out your hand. Do you want to hold $1 million?" And drop this putty in her hand.
Right, and as I recall, that was the putty that was used to as a window sealer for airplanes, for cockpits.
And they couldn't get it to work the way they wanted it to, so it wound up becoming silly putty, a kid's toy.
Yes, that was a fun story. There were so many of these engineering... That was another reason she had credibility. She had all these anecdotes about engineering that was going on there. You know, and of course, some of them were funny and some of them weren't. They were... You know, she talked about how they had... I remember another funny one that I recall was when they made a bad mistake when they were trying to drop a heavy payload, some sort of vehicle, and they misjudged the wind, and it landed in the backyard of a colonel on the base. So the wife was extremely upset.
And I don't doubt that at all.
There's kind of an interesting spin on that, too, because June knew all this information about parachutes, not just regular parachuting, but the way the military looks at parachutes, as to how to suspend a heavy payload, drop it out of an aircraft onto a battlefield, like some sort of combat vehicle or a jeep or something, and have it land on the ground undamaged. Well, she kept saying, I remember several times, she said, Kanaki wrote the Bible on parachutes. And I looked all over the place for this Kanaki. I had no idea who this person was. Until I went to this meeting down in Southern California back in 2000 that I told you about, when I first met Ryan Wood and the Majestic Documents researchers, and I met this one gentleman there who said, "I will help you, but you could never mention my name." And after I talked to him a little bit, I got the impression that he was somehow involved in the intelligence community. Well, out of the blue, several months after I went down there, I get this envelope, and inside is this very technical journal from an old copy of basically a magazine, one of these Inside the Air Force publications. This would not be it was a magazine. I mean, it wasn't classified, but it's not something that would be normally distributed to the public. And lo and behold, inside this, I find this extremely technical article with all these formulas and everything else written by a man named Walter Kanaki, and it was all about how to estimate the air temperature on these cords that are used to suspend a heavy payload from a parachute dropped onto a battlefield. So once again, June's story gained credibility. She knew people that even, you know, you can't normally find, and yet it turned out that these names that she mentioned were the real deal. So, you know, you take all of these little pieces and put them together, and her credibility keeps going up and up and up.
Another thing I thought was interesting is that at the time of the interview that the transcript is up for, she felt that some of the UFOs that are cited are ours. That they're made right here in the state.
Now the context that I took that in, some of what I didn't pin her down on every single part, because obviously my goal was to get her to reveal things and talk to me, but my understanding of that, some of what she said was her supposition. Some of what she was telling me, of course, was based on her direct experience. And I'm not sure that she had, I don't recall that she gave me details about that, but that this was one of the things that was speculated upon by these scientists and engineers that she knew who worked at Wright-Patterson.
Yes, that's the way I took it, too, is that, that she suspects that suspects that some of these objects that people are seeing aren't, not all of them are alien technology. Some of them are reverse engineered, built by us.
Exactly. And of course that's in keeping with a lot of other research that has been done since then. Now I would want to point out also that June had made some attempts to research her own, you know, what she had heard and saw at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, but I, being in her home, it wasn't like she had three bookshelves full of UFO books. In other words, one of the things that you're always concerned about is whether you're getting something genuine or whether somebody's telling you something that they had read or heard themselves. Obviously, as an investigator, you want to sort that out. And I think that that was another point, that another reason why she was included in the Majestic Documents Project, was that her revelations were made independent of all of these other researchers. So this is what you would call a corroborating witness, someone who knows what happened but doesn't really have any relationship or exposure to the other witnesses. Those witnesses are always extremely valuable in any investigation.
Oh, I agree. I agree thoroughly. We have about 5 minutes left before we go to our top of the hour break. Is there anything else you would like to add about June?
No, just that I keep thinking, I feel like sometimes like I still have a connection to her, because things happen. Like you mentioned that Hangar 18, that actually is an episode of the UFO Files, and that's been an extremely successful episode, and for some strange reason, I have no idea why, that particular episode is shown very frequently. It's been rerun multiple times. In fact, I heard that it's about to be shown again, and my wife had a funny anecdote, because one of her friends, another nurse, came back from her honeymoon and said, "Your husband was in my bedroom." And I said, you know, she said, "Well, what are you talking about?" And she said they had gone to Hawaii and they were on their honeymoon and they just turned on the television for a minute and it happened to be the UFO Files, and the next picture they saw was a picture of me as a young police officer, because that's part of the June story on that episode. I guess it's just a funny anecdote. It keeps coming back to me, so I feel like June is still creating a positive influence for me.
Oh, bless her heart. I've got a quick question that was sent in to me here from our virtual auditorium. Gossamer777 asks, did she ever point out any modern technologies that she felt might have been derived from retrieved alien technology? Anything she might have heard while at Wright Pat?
I wish I could tell you that we did, but no. The only thing I can tell you is that when we talked about the memory metal, I tried to basically argue against her just a little bit to see where she would go. And I said, okay, you've lived through the modern era, you've seen all these plastics, you've seen... And she interrupted me and she said, no, it's not like anything I've ever seen. That metal is completely different. There isn't anything that we've developed since then that's like that. This, you know... In context, this metal was not made by the human race. This is non-terrestrial technology.
Very, very interesting. We've got about 2 minutes till we go to the next break. In our next hour, we're going to discuss, and try not too much to spoil your presentation in Las Vegas in November, but a little bit more on the Elk River or Westport, rather, Westport, Washington UFO crash of 1979. That will be very interesting. I've never heard anything about this.
It's not a commonly known crash case. I've seen it, I believe, on Leonard Stringfield's list of UFO crashes. I think it's briefly dealt with in there. I recall finding one publication that mentioned it very briefly in a long list, that it wasn't verified. I think it wasn't verified because nobody ever investigated it. I have more than enough information. I'm convinced now that this one will make the list in the future of UFO crashes and recoveries.
This will be an interesting discussion then, because along with my audience, I'm going to be learning about this for the first time myself. And on that note, we need to go to a break. First, I want to let our listeners know that they can listen to Paranormal Radio Network in this program simply by calling 704-631-4060 and entering our four-digit station ID code 2899. That's 704-631-4060 and the ID code 2898. And on that, we'll be back in a while here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network with Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on 105.3 in New Orleans.
Hi, you've got to listen to ICA.
And like... And welcome back to Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network and broadcast live on 103.3 New Orleans. I'm your host, Dee Andrew, and tonight I've been talking with James Clarkson. James, a question that David, my husband, asked me to ask you during the break, and I wanted to wait till we came back live, was in all your time as a police officer and investigating, you know, your background with investigations in the police department and investigating UFOs, is there any one time or other times when you're investigating a UFO-related incident that you get some kind of stonewalling, trying to block what you're doing?
I haven't had that yet, and I guess part of it is, you know, I should back up just a bit. I did apply to get June's records from the National Records Bureau as a, you know, former government employee. Her records are kept in a depository in St. Louis, and it took 5 Freedom of Information Act request letters her files sent to me. And in fact, I had just about given up, and all at once one day I got this huge envelope mail that had all of her records. So that's probably the closest that I've come. Now, I should qualify that and just say, you know, I haven't had the type of case where I would expect that since then. Now, I did get stone, well, I guess now that I'm going into this, I did send Freedom of Information Act requests in connection with the Elk River crash that I believe we're going to talk about here shortly, and stonewalling, I guess no more or less so than anyone else, I got what I call the blah blah letters from the Air Force, from the NORAD, from the Washington State Department of Transportation. I felt that all of these agencies were probably involved in knowing something about this crash, and of course, they would say that they had cooperated fully with my Freedom of Information Act request, but what they sent me was not really terribly useful. So I guess you would call that stonewalling.
Oh, yeah, I would. Very, very typical, too.
Yes.
I think John Greenwald could relate to that quite well as well. Getting back to this Westport, Washington crash, UFO crash of 79, you were saying that there was a lot of people involved in this. Roughly about how many?
Well, I guess it's a matter of scale. Probably back then, Grace Harbor County as a whole, which I guess to sort of locate it for people, we're talking about Washington State. We're talking about the southwest Washington coast. Interstate 5, as the highway, runs north and south through Washington, and so everybody on the west side of the mountains in Washington does their geography based on Interstate 5. Seattle, of course, is the big city. Up north, it's probably about 75 miles north of Olympia, where I am, which is the state capital. If you go due west from here, 50 miles, the Chehalis River empties into Grays Harbor. To the north is a community called Ocean Shores that we talked about in connection with June Crane. And then to the south, just about the same distance, kind of like a big triangle, if you drive about 26, 27 miles, you get to a small fishing town called Westport, and there's probably 2,000 to 3,000 people there. And outside of Westport, there are unincorporated communities. There's Acosta, Grayland, and these are all in the area that I would be talking about related to this crash. And basically what you've got is another one of the rivers that's emptying into the Grays Harbor Basin, and then therefore into the Pacific Ocean, is the Elk River. There's all kinds of creeks and whatnot. You got to bear in mind that Washington is called the Evergreen State for a really good reason, and west of the mountains, we get a huge amount of rainfall, so much so that up north on the Olympic Peninsula, they actually have what is a true rainforest. So most of the time, we get heavy rainfall, a lot of runoff. And this, of course, kind of ties into the story of the Elk River crash. It's one of the reasons it's so difficult to figure out the exact spot where the crash occurred is because of the vegetation, logging, replanting, etc. The area where the crash occurred used to be owned privately by various logging companies and a few private citizens, and now the whole area is a natural resource conservation area.
Oh, interesting. Okay, can you give us some more of the particulars of what happened?
Sure.
In 79, like what date?
Exactly, and now that I've kind of painted the geography, just about 3 miles exactly outside of town, there's State Route 105 out of Aberdeen that goes this 25-mile distance down to the city of Westport. When you're about 3 miles out of Westport, you go over this bridge, and it's called the Elk River Bridge. And 1 p.m. on Sunday night, November 25th, 1979, multiple people, beginning probably 35 to 40 miles away, there were numerous people who observed a brilliant large light in the sky coming down from high up in the northeast and traveling in a southwest direction. In the area right near the crash site, it actually stopped traffic. There wasn't a huge amount of traffic, but the cars that were out there, everybody stopped their car to look at this thing coming down. And it went over the bridge and across the mud flats and crashed in these low hills. One individual in particular, the first official report that we know of, he went through the front doors of the Westport Police Station. He drove to the nearest place that he could, and at that time the Westport Police Station was manned 24 hours a day. This, of course, is long before 911 or anything like that. So this man comes hysterical through the front door and says, my God, there's been a crash, all of that. People out in a, by the city of Elma, Elma is 20 miles east of Aberdeen, so we're talking actually, I guess, 40, 45 miles away, driving on the main highway towards Aberdeen, recall a huge greenish-white flare going by them. The interesting, the best account that I got from anybody was this elderly woman in an area called Central Park that's about 3-4 miles east of Aberdeen. She told me, and of course this is several years later when I went back and talked to her, she remembered specifically what movie of the week on Sunday night she never got to see the end of because she saw this brilliant set of lights coming down out of the sky, and she said it didn't look like anything she'd ever seen, and it looked like a row of windows, like some sort of an airliner, except that the size was all wrong, and the lights were very odd. She said this thing was bigger at the top than at the bottom, and she described how her link to this event, it almost had kind of a psychic overtone, because she kept saying, my God, they're in trouble, they're out of power. And this, it was really interesting the way she described this, and once again, like I mentioned before, the intensity in her voice and her description was really there. And she saw this thing, once again, coming from high up in the northeast. Now, she could not see Westport from where she lived, obviously, but it went in the same direction. So if you took maps, and I did actually ask each person, what direction was the object when you first saw it, and what direction was it going when you last saw it? And you can just connect the dots, and the whole thing fits together. I interviewed the police dispatchers who were on duty at the Grace Harbor County Sheriff's Office, and I interviewed the dispatcher in Aberdeen, and all of them recalled that they were swamped with calls about this thing. So whatever this thing was, it was big, it was highly illuminated, it came down burning or flaming or something, and it went across, again, the Elk River Bridge and crashed in the hills. So I'm completely convinced that something crashed there. Now, the interesting thing is, I wish I could tell you, in 1979, when this event happened, I was hired by the Aberdeen Police Department in May of 1979. Unfortunately, I have to admit that as a young police officer who was going through his probationary year, I wasn't reading the local newspaper. And you don't get out very much in the daylight. You get to work all the graveyard shifts when you're new. If I had been watching the newspaper, I would have seen that the next day, on November 26th, the headline story in the Aberdeen Daily World, which is the biggest newspaper in Grace Harbor County, the headline actually says, UFO wreckage in Elk River, ? And it goes on, and it started identifying all of these witnesses. This ended up being the first of a series of 5 newspaper articles that were all related to this crash. And the second and third articles related actual witness names, people who had called in and told their story, and this news reporter had gone and found these people and got their story to include in his article. And by a strange set of circumstances, I guess this is another one of those coincidences, this man's name was John Dodge, and as a young reporter, he worked for the Aberdeen Daily World, and it wasn't until 1987, after I had joined MUFON, that I actually investigated this case, and I ended up talking to him then. Well, many years later, in 2008, my wife was a hospice nurse, and she knew one of her coworkers at this agency, turned out to be the fiancé of John Dodge now. And it turns out that years later, he was now a reporter for the newspaper here in Olympia, the Daily Olympian, And so he remembered all of this, so I was able to go over all this ground with him again, and he was kind of, you know, he was really helpful to me in renewing this investigation for what I'm hoping will be a very successful presentation in Las Vegas.
So, I think it's going to be. So far, I'm fascinated.
The other thing that adds a lot of credibility to this is that the way that I learned about this case was, of course, I mentioned in 1987 I joined MUFON, and that was because of a particular UFO case that was all over the news. I don't know if you remember it, but it was the Captain Taroshi, who was flying a cargo jet for JAL, saw a huge UFO outside of Anchorage, Alaska, and they had a confirmation on radar. And, of course, then when everybody got interested in it, then the FAA said, no, we really didn't see it on the radar, although we did say that we did, and it was the usual runaround. But I, as a result of that, I joined MUFON. Well, then, a while later, this would have been in April of 1987, I'd been with the department now since 1979, and I guess, as I mentioned before, I reached a point where I thought, hey, I'm just going to be who I am, and this happens to be the subject that I really love. So I started talking to my fellow officers, deputy sheriffs, police officers in Aberdeen, Hoquiam, some of the surrounding cities, and also Westport police officers about this event, or about UFOs in general. Well, I kept hearing this story about a crash and a cover-up and a recovery, and they always said Andrews Creek, Elk River, near Grayland or Westport. And then I started hearing that the military responded, that they did some kind of a retrieval, and that there may have been what they called re-landscaping in the area of the crash. Now, of course, some of the things that I heard, I didn't really put too much credence, because people did start talking about bodies at the crash site. And, of course, part of what I was worried about was that I was getting contamination. In other words, sometimes when an event is really big in an area, people want attention, and they will tell you things that, you know, just because they want to be part of the action. So you want to make sure that your story actually has credibility. Well, I decided that I wanted to, you know, I had talked to many people down there in the community, and a lot of what I was hearing was rumors. Some people seemed to have details, some didn't. I started talking to law enforcement officers, and I met this one gentleman who retired just in the last year or so. He was in law enforcement with the sheriff's office for 20-some years, ended up being a sergeant working in the jail. But at the time of the crash, he was a shake block cutter down in the Westport area. So this man had a lot more credibility, somebody I knew and had worked with, because, you know, we transport our prisoners to the county sheriff's office, and you get to know people. Well, I ended up interviewing him because he actually saw Army Jeeps with canvas tops down on the logging roads, and he said that he was turned away when he tried to go to work on Monday and Tuesday, and that the military had blocked the logging roads, and they told the soldier he talked to, said that there were maneuvers going on and that the public was being kept out for their own safety. Now, he never did see any troops on maneuvers, but he and many other people stated that the roads were indeed blocked. Well, the next person that I contacted, this is a really interesting story. There was a sergeant at Grays Harbor County who was really well known and really well liked. This was the sergeant who, you got to bear in mind, this is back in the old days before things were quite so formal. On Christmas Eve, they would clear the police radio channel, and this sergeant read The Night Before Christmas over the air for the benefit of those, you know, officers and deputy sheriffs who had to work on Christmas Eve and weren't at home with their family. So he's, you know, this, just to give you an idea of, this guy was a real interesting man. His background was that he had been a Navy SEAL, and he was still active in Coast Guard intelligence. Now, he, of course, would. You always kind of knew when you talked to him that there was something more going on with him than he was telling you. He was really interested in this crash story, and he said that at the time that it happened, he was assigned to that end of Grace Harbor County, and he actually organized kind of an ad hoc search group using a four-wheel drive club out of Westport, and he got them to go out and search the logging roads. Well, the part of what he heard was consistent was that there were multiple descriptions of the object, something definitely came down and crashed, and that there had been numerous people who'd called in about it. Some people described it as being the size of a small plane. Some people said it was a much larger plane. There were reports that it was a disc-shaped object. There were reports that it was falling, smoking, or that it was on fire when it came down. There were numerous people in the community who said that they had been stopped by troops, but he didn't have anybody that he was willing, that he either told me about or was willing to tell me about, who actually saw military personnel. But there is kind of a however in this. The however is that he told me that he was having lunch at a restaurant sometime after that down in the Westport area. And he actually met a SEAL, a group of Navy SEALs, who weren't on duty. Now, this would seem to be a little odd, except that Pacific Beach, which is over on the other side of the harbor, is north of Ocean Shores, is actually a bona fide military, I guess, place for R&R. They have cabins that can be rented and all of that. And a few years back, it was actually one of the facilities that was used for communicating with nuclear submarines. Now, of course, there have been rumors about what might still be going on there, etc. But in any event, so he talked to these SEALs, and he told me that he tried to get them to talk about what might have crashed. The only thing that he said they would tell him is that they reminded him that one of their missions is to be able to respond anywhere in the coastal United States within 4 to 6 hours, and they are trained for rescuing occupants of water-downed aircraft. And they are also trained to secure and recover aircraft of interest.
Hmm.
And they wouldn't tell him anything past that. He said that one of them kind of winked at him while he was telling the story. So that was kind of interesting. Now, there's an afterword on this, which is that I've tried to contact this sergeant afterwards. I'm sure that I got a letter to him, because he ended up moving back east, and I believe that the last career position that he held, he was the chief of police for Annapolis, Maryland.
Oh,
now,
wow.
Yes. And I actually found a newspaper article that I believe it's a picture of him in there identified in that position. This was a very intelligent, very sharp individual. He was one of those, I mean, he was a really good deputy sheriff and a really good sergeant, but it was like there was more to him than that, and it was like he should have been something else and probably was. He wouldn't respond to my letter. He still hasn't. And I don't know why. I mean, there could be a million reasons. He's older. He's a lot older. It could be, you know, it could be health reasons. It could be anything. It could also be that after he left Grays Harbor and he sort of re-immersed himself in the intelligence community, maybe he doesn't want to talk with a UFO investigator. That's another possibility. So I started... go ahead.
Well, he could be wanting to stay out of it to protect his new job as well.
He's retired now.
Oh, okay.
That much I'm certain of. But he was obviously an important lead in this investigation and had an awful lot of credibility, especially for helping to establish the basics. I contacted the head of the National UFO Reporting Center. At that time was not Peter Davenport. It was a man named Bob Gribble who preceded Peter Davenport. He, by the way, is a retired Seattle firefighter who loved UFOs so much that he started the national hotline. And interestingly enough, I knew that phone number by heart, 206-722-3000. The reason I knew it was I had seen it years before on the military police desk at Fort Lewis. And I was a plainclothes MP. I was what was called MPI. So I wore civilian clothes for most of my enlistment. And that's kind of a neat way to work in the military, because everyone, even though I was just an enlisted man, everyone thinks you're an officer, so they treat you with way more military courtesy than your rank really warrants. But that's fine, because it makes it easier to do your job. But I looked at the military police desk one night. I was talking to the desk sergeant, and I looked underneath this piece of glass on top of his desk, and I my eyes just about fell out of my head. I looked down, and here's this business card that says National UFO Reporting Center. And I said, "What's this?" And he said, "That's where we report UFOs." So that stuck in my mind, and after I got out, and years later, I'm an Aberdeen policeman, and I'm starting to research this case, I called that number, and that's, that was how I got some good basic information, because he had received numerous reports about this incident. That eventually led me to the Aberdeen Daily World, and that's how I got all these newspaper articles. And, of course, once I got the newspaper articles, then I really knew that I was on something. I met a former Westport police officer named Fred Bradshaw. He actually had notes. He still had his notes from when this thing happened. He had interviewed a man named Larry Lake, who was the first person to report seeing an object on fire traveling in a southwest direction at a very fast speed. He heard a story. Unfortunately, his notes, he didn't have the names, but two women, supposedly from the Grayland or Tokeland area, had found a metal object allegedly 15 to 30 feet long, 10 to 12 feet high, and one side was burned and open. There were reports of the Army and the FBI being in the area. He gave me a couple of other names. One of them was a subject named Gordon Graham, who I would guess is probably deceased by now. I interviewed him in person. I got a statement from him. He gave me a lot of details. However, his son made a point of calling me up and telling me that he thought his father wasn't credible. And
why would he say that?
Well, he was telling me that his father was an alcoholic and he had problems with, medication and whatnot. And there may have been some evidence of that. But then he went on to tell me that he saw military cargo copters in the area at the same time as this incident. So I thought that was kind of odd, because on the one hand, he discredits his father, but on the other hand, he tells me that he himself saw unusual military activity in the area. So you got to kind of bear in mind, Grace Harbor County had a lot of economic trouble. The logging industry has come and gone. A lot of people are displaced. There is a high level of alcoholism and drug problems in the area, which I don't, particularly know one way or the other whether Mr. Graham suffered from that, except as his son alluded to it. But I also interviewed other witnesses who, were able to paint more of a picture. I interviewed Estella Krussel. She's the elderly lady that I already talked about who saw this huge object coming down out of the sky, and she said this was bright like mercury lights. And then she, of course, gave that additional description. And I kept getting more witnesses. Several people, in fact, I have it in my notes, I've got at least 10 different people who identified a specific individual as being the key witness. They claim that he was a high school student at the time. His name was Tuffy Miller. Tuffy Miller supposedly actually got into the area and took pictures of whatever it was. And it's really interesting because here I've got all these people that are not related to each other that all identify the same man. I'm contacting him. He's now 7 years later. I get a hold of him, and I talk to him on the phone, and he is real abrupt with me and says, "No, that never happened. I wasn't there. I didn't see anything. I don't know anything about this." And yet all of these people had identified him over and over again. But they also said that his family was really, really poor, and that after this crash, they bought new pickup trucks. And they just thought that it was odd that suddenly they had money.
A la Mac Brazel.
Yeah, exactly. Now, going through these articles and reconstructing what happened, the next thing that happens is we find out that there was an actual search number put on this incident by Scott Air Force Base in Illinois. The justification was because of the reports of so many sightings in the area. Now, the weird part is nobody was missing any aircraft. There were no airplanes, no missing helicopters, nobody reported anything in the way of a conventional aircraft. And yet, the next article that comes out, we have the County Director of Emergency Services saying that the Civil Air Patrol has a theory. It supposedly is a Bell helicopter, a Bell Jet Ranger, with its landing lights on and had exhaust flame from a stack 4 to 5 inches across. Well, that gets really interesting because I ended up interviewing some helicopter pilots, and the one gentleman pointed out to me, another one of the theories was somehow this was a leaking helicopter. And he said that these turbine aircraft, these helicopters, only have about 4 to 5 quarts of fluid in them like that for lubrication, and that you can't burn it anyway because it's designed not to catch fire until almost 800 degrees. And if you were to lose any substantial amount of that fluid, you wouldn't be in the air anyway, let alone fly 40 or 50 miles before you crashed. He said it wouldn't happen. So the conventional explanation, this is a classic cover-up. This is, you know, hey, we're going to tell the public something so that nobody will be curious about it anymore. Now, at the time, even in those newspaper articles, John Dodge, the reporter, interviewed Lee Heyman from the Washington Helicopter Service. He said there were few commercial flights in the area, no exhaust was seen, and that these craft appear dark and they don't have any exhaust glow. The military couldn't even keep their stories straight. A warrant officer who flies masked flights made the comment that exhaust glow is minor in flight. So the official version is not backed up by military personnel. So the rumors go on, and the last article was on Friday, December 14th, 1979. This is the one really odd statement, and this is what I would call your classic tongue-in-cheek statement. A Major Ralph Padueno, the Army Information Officer of Fort Lewis, is quoted as saying, "We're certainly not guarding anything in the Elk River area." Well, that statement is extremely disingenuous because that's not it at all. Obviously, by December 14th, the military had been and gone. They weren't guarding anything there because they had already taken it away. And that's what all the people in the area said. There were funny little anecdotes in which people who didn't see it crash, but people who said that things were odd around there, and by odd, you got to bear in mind, this is before cell phones. So one individual says, "Yeah, I was going down to get my mail out of my mailbox, and I see this officer from the Army with all this gold on his cap, and he's in a phone booth talking to somebody, and he's got this unmarked car sitting there." Now, do I know if all of this is true? I can't absolutely verify it, but there's way, way too much smoke in this investigation for there not to be any fire. I'm absolutely convinced that something crashed down there in Elk River. The military did respond. They sealed off the logging roads, and whatever it was, they took it away. Now, there is a rest of the story here because this year I re-interviewed a witness whose report I had initially, and what he told me was extremely startling.
I find that very interesting. Oh, gosh. How did you first find out about this?
Just because, you know, sometimes, for instance, we had a downtown car. We would run four or five patrol cars. And our downtown car, when we would have a lot of... Aberdeen is a rough and tumble town. There are a lot of bar fights. So frequently we would run a two-officer car downtown. Well, it doesn't stay busy all night, and you got to make conversation, and you got two officers sitting in a car, and you start talking about things. Well, gradually over time, people began to know that I would take them seriously on the subject of UFOs. So I started hearing things. And I don't remember who it was, the first officer that I talked to, but, you know, eventually somebody said, hey, go talk to Larry, you know, who works at the jail, because he knows about this. Or go talk to Sergeant Robertson, because he launched a search for that thing. He knows all about this case. And so, you know, the law enforcement officers don't talk about such things outside of their ranks. But if you're within their ranks, there's a lot of trust. In other words, people get to know each other. You get to where you trust people. You know that, you know, this other officer's got your back. And so you feel a lot freer to talk about things, and that's how I first heard about this.
Okay. Do you find your investigative training helps you a lot in studying these different cases that you worked and investigated? And do you think that these police techniques could be taught to other investigators and that they would be useful?
Yes. The answer is absolutely yes. And yet it might not be the kind of police tactics that people would normally think of. The one skill that I pride myself in, that I've probably spent the most time with, to be an effective police officer, you have to be able to communicate with just about anybody. And you have to be able to make conversation with them. No one has to tell you anything voluntarily. You have to, if a person is a suspect, you have to advise them of their rights. So the truth of the matter is, they don't have to tell you anything. The same thing is true of witnesses. Most people will try to help you, and I think if you take a positive attitude, most of the time you're going to get the information that you need. But in the end, you're selling people on the idea of telling you the important information that you need. So what I'm really talking about is your ability to communicate with other people. The next skill that I would say is extremely important is your ability to organize information. In other words, you are going to take what is a chaotic event. A whole bunch of people see something really strange and exciting. Okay, how are you going to present that? How are you going to break that down? Is there a timeline? Who was the first person to see it? Who was the last person to see it? You know, what happened afterwards? In other words, you got to have a systematic approach to information if you want to present it to other people, to know what, and it always comes back to your communication skills. That's fundamental. And absolutely, I use that in the field of UFOs because, unfortunately, so many of the cases that we're confronted with, there is no physical evidence. Doesn't mean they didn't happen. It just means that there isn't anything there physically that we can reproduce or show to somebody else.
Now, I'm finding that a lot of police techniques are being used in investigations. For example, the first crash retrieval conference I went to, I met Ken Storch, who I believe is still part of the police department, and I forget which city in Colorado. And he's a MUFON investigator, and he uses a lot of his investigative techniques that he uses as a police officer in his investigations. And also, Bill Chalker in Australia, last I heard, was attempting to put together, as he referred to it, a CSI-type quick response team for abduction research.
This is fascinating.
And I've been trying to get a hold of Chalker to get more information on that, but so far, no luck. So if anybody's out there, you know, has a way that I can get a hold of Bill Chalker, let me know. I would deeply appreciate it. we've got, let's see, about 7 minutes to go. Going to your other investigation, not necessarily this Elk River incident, what is another case that you've worked on that you found very interesting?
Well, there was one in 1988 involved a wife and a husband and their son up here in Mason County. I'm in Thurston County. One of the other counties that borders on Thurston County is Mason. They have many, many small lakes. And on the shore of one of these lakes, this family had a two-story house. They lived on the upper floor, have a very large deck, big windows. The trees around the house are 40 to 50 feet high, a very beautiful setting. Well, one night the family is watching television, and the mother is bored. She gets up and kind of wanders outside because she sees this funny light coming over the lake. A moment later, she screams, and her husband and her son run out on the deck to join her, and they all look up just in time to see not one, but three of the very large black triangle craft going over the house. And I remember when I interviewed the husband, I said, "Did it sound like anything?" And he said, "You're not going to believe me." And I said, "Try me." And he said, "You know in the Star Wars movies," he said, "you know when the Darth Vader is in that huge spaceship, and when it flies right above, you hear that kind of big roaring sound like a huge electrical motor or something?" He said, "That's what these were like. There was one in the front, and then I guess his two wingmen. They all three of them made drawings of what they had seen that night, including the small boy. The classic black triangle. Very odd configuration of lights, not like anything conventional. The one in the front had some kind of a spotlight that was actually moving and as if something was looking down at the trees. And these things went overhead and then they were gone. Now, interestingly enough, you can take the diagram that the wife made and you compare it to, I believe it was in Illinois in 2000, there were sightings one night of this huge triangle. I know there's been a reconstructed video. It's been part of a special on the UFO files because most of the key witnesses in this case were law enforcement officers. And I looked at one of the reports by the law enforcement officer that was posted online. And attached to his report was his drawing of the craft that he saw. And including the lights, if you took his sketch and you could just about put it over the one that was made by the wife from the sighting over her house out here in Shelton, Washington in 1988. So there's kind of an eerie similarity. I keep getting reports about these mysterious triangles even more often than I get reports about your classic flying disc. And there's something really strange going on with these black triangles. There's no doubt about it. And that they kind of stand out in my mind because I keep bumping into them.
Oh, interesting. That's strange. You know, those have been spotted since, well, gosh, 1980.
Exactly. And I interviewed on another case two fishermen who were up by the top of Mount Rainier outside of a small town called Elby that's on the highway to go to the top. I think it's State Highway 7. Well, they described how they're driving down in their pickup truck, and I think they were going in to get something from this little market, and all at once the one guy thought, the first thing they both thought was that an airliner was going to crash land on the road, because they saw this huge light coming down onto the roadway, and they thought, my God. So they pulled up their truck, and they tried to find a place to pull off, because they thought something really bad was about to happen. Well, when they end up going, they can't find a place, and they end up underneath this thing. And it turns out to be one of these huge black triangles. They get scared, and they start picking up speed, trying to get away from it on the highway. Instead of turning around, this thing just backs through the air above them. They start going faster, and it goes faster. Eventually, they got to a place where they could pull off the road. He pulls into this parking area, and this thing goes sideways at a 90-degree angle and goes over the top of the nearby mountain, and that's it. And they don't know what happens after that. But the weird part is, again, I interviewed these two men separately. They both told stories that fit together exactly, and you could sense this excitement in their voice when they got to the part where they described their encounter with this huge black triangle. I mean, they were scared, no doubt about it, but they were also really excited and really curious, because they wanted to know what was this extraordinary aircraft that didn't fly like anything they'd ever seen before. Both of them had military experience.
Wow. And unfortunately, we're out of time. I could go on for another hour myself.
I'm sure I could.
But unfortunately, like we are out of time. And Jim, I want to thank you again for squeezing us back into your schedule because of the hurricane 2 weeks ago. And for everybody listening, check out the UFO Crash Retrieval Conference, their website, and off the top of my head, I can't think of the address. Okay, thank you, David. UFOconference.com, where James will be speaking, and hopefully David and I will be able to attend that ourselves and get to meet you face-to-face. I'd love that.
That'd be wonderful.
And also, I want to let everyone know that all of the people who are affected by the hurricanes over the last few weeks, our thoughts and prayers are with you all. Hope everything comes out all right for everybody. Also, to listen, got to get this in here real quick, to listen to the Paranormal Radio Network, you can access by simply calling 704-631-4060 and entering the four-digit station ID code 2899. And I want to thank everybody in the Pal Talk Auditorium and all of our listeners. And to stay tuned for Voices of People, hosted by November Hansen. Her guest tonight will be author Stephen Mitchell. So join me again next Saturday on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network for another episode of Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis. Until then, keep an eye to the sky. Good night, everyone. And I guess we're clear.
Oh, good.
Oh, man, well, I enjoyed this.